Hi, this is Abraham Engel. Welcome to Neighborhood Diaries. In 2009, I recorded the location-based memories of Portland tours and wove them together into these free interactive audio tours. You can download more tours by searching for Hood Turkey in the iTunes store or by going to my website at www.hoodturkey.com, where you can also check out my other projects. This project was supported in part by a grant from the Regional Arts and Culture Council and by generous folks like you. To find out how you can donate with one click, go to hoodturkey.com. Unless otherwise stated, all the memories you hear were recorded by me, and all the music underneath them was composed by me, but I had lots of help with editing and other things by the following amazing people: Johnny Toadvine, Lena Munde, Nancy Wong, Mia Armstrong, and Carl Hugo. Also, I want to thank all my friends and family. Alright, so listen up. This is how you use the tour. I'm not going to be giving you a lot of directions. They're free maps you can download at hoodturkey.com if you haven't already picked one up. This is the memory-only tour, which means that there's no music in between the memories. So when one memory ends, just pause your player and hit play again when you reach the next location. You can let the natural sounds of the neighborhood be your soundtrack. If this is the iPod-enhanced version, you'll notice markers in the timeline. This means you can skip and go back to memories as if they were songs. Even if you don't use the iPod-enhanced version, you can look at the map and see the times at which each memory is played, so you can jump around that way. Alright, one last thing before we start the tour. This is a long tour, and the memories are kind of crunched up in some places and sprawled out in other places, so feel free to break them up at your own discretion. You won't hurt my feelings by not hurting your feet. With that said, we'll start the tour. Okay, thanks to everyone who donated memory and or money and or time. Thanks to Iraq for their support. Thanks to the bands for donating their music. Thanks to my friends and family, and thank you for listening.
Going to a gay bar for the first time. Stark Street was called Vaseline Alley for years. Back in the late 80s, it was definitely the gay neighborhood. You don't see that anymore. Gentrification's kind of whitewashed everything. You would go park your car over off of, 10th Avenue, and you'd walk down 10th Avenue, and terrified that any car going by, they would know you. Someone in that car knew you, and by the time you got to Stark Street, the only reason you're on Stark Street is to go to a gay bar, so of course anyone driving on it is apparently staring at everyone. Maybe that's what you're thinking. So I'd hold my head down, I'd be looking at the street, and the minute that light turned, run across, go straight into the bar. Just the fear. And back then too, the bars were, you had more posing doormen. If you were a girl, you couldn't get into them. And for boys, you didn't really have to have ID. Just the fact that you were a boy meant that you could get in really easily. But there was always a much more imposing, body there. So that was, so now you've crossed the street and you've gone through this horror of maybe someone that your mom or your dad or your brother seen you, and then you have to face this huge hunk of a man who's guarding the door. So it seemed like these huge obstacles. Of course, now you look back, you laugh at it, but it seemed you weren't going to make it in there as much as you wanted to. Then, of course, you got in there, and there was a whole other battle of, who's looking at you kind of stuff. It was fun. I miss that feeling that it's not okay. Nowadays it is okay, and everything's acceptable. Well, not completely, but moving in that direction. Which is good too, overall, but you do want to have that sense of, you're doing something that is maybe naughty.
I was leaving coffee time at closing time, which is 2:30 a.m. because there's no 24-hour places open on a Monday. So I decided to walk downtown and walk to the MAC station so I could check the Yellow Line schedule and take that, the earliest one, up to North Portland to get a job because I was homeless and I was looking for a job. And I was given this job lead by this homeless guy who said to me that he knew that if you went to the Paul Bunyan statue at 5 a.m. and the train would start running at 4 a.m., you'd get a job driving cars for the police auction. So I thought, hey, great, I can get money, get myself off the streets, and finally, you know, get out of this terrible situation of rain and poverty and food lines and smelly homeless guys. So I made my way from the coffee shop down to 10th and Yamhill, which is the MAC station, to sort of wait and check the train schedules and get out of the rain. On my way there, I heard two guys shuffling behind me, like their feet were making noise on purpose. I didn't really think too much of it because they were, you know, it was bar closing time, people were drunk, people really move around, and, you know, people are inclined to do unorthodox things because they have alcohol in their system. Whereas me, I was just looking to get a job in the morning. So I stopped to check out the Yellow Line schedule, and on my way there, the shuffling of feet came louder, then came past me, which I assumed to be just time drunk stuff. One guy went past me, another guy dropped back, so that one guy was behind me, one guy's in front of me, and right as I was about to check the schedule, the guy in front of me stopped, and the guy behind me stopped and said,
"Give me your money."
Now, considering I was homeless, I thought this was almost comical, so I just started laughing, and then I realized they were serious when they pulled a gun and a knife. And I don't know, I tried to reassure them that I did not have any money and they'd be wasting their time, but one guy tried to stab my coat and didn't really pierce the pea coat that I had. So I wasn't too scared. It was more just a formality that now that these guys were assumed robbers and I'd have to give them what I owned, which was absolutely nothing. Actually, I take that back. I had a laptop in my, a laptop case, man purse thing. And I put that down and I stood on it. And one guy shoved me off, grabbed it, and started to run. And the other guy grabbed my wallet. And they both took off. I remember yelling after them, "Hey, that's my life!" Meaning the laptop, because that's where I do all my work on there. And it turns out that, as soon as I said that, the guy didn't want to run with it because the laptop was so heavy. They just ran for my wallet, and I remember in the middle of the night yelling, "You idiots, there's nothing in the wallet. I'm completely broke." And chasing after them, yelling, and some homeless guy said, "Hey, man, you're keeping me up."
Around the corner on Jefferson, so this was on 12th and Jefferson, around the corner was the Jefferson Theater. And my mother and I went there once or twice a week. She was a ballet dancer in New York before I was born, and she loved the theater. I remember seeing The Man with the Golden Arm and Barefoot Contessa, which we walked out on. And we'd also go to all the movies downtown, the Paramount. And the Paramount is where I found a $20 bill on the floor. And I loved those theaters because they were gilded. The Paramount was red velvet everywhere. It was very exciting. I have one of those little 5-year diaries. And it gives a lot of names of the movies we saw and who were in them. It's like 4 lines. And that's what one of the entries was. Walked out on Barefoot Contessa. I can't compare it to now. My first memory is on 12th and Jefferson, and it was an apartment house, it's still there, that I lived in from 1954 through 1956. I was in the second and third grade. We lived on the third floor in the back, overlooking a fire escape with a big cherry tree in bloom often. And through the cherry tree was the KEX studio. And we used to grow pansies on the fire escape. And it had a living room, bathroom, sort of kitchen, and bedroom. My bed was in a Murphy bed that you pulled out from the wall like a fireplace, which when I got really scared, I'd pull in because you could be totally hidden, at least from a kid's point of view, you were hidden. The woman next door had a TV, which was the first time I'd seen a TV, and that meant that I could watch Mickey Mouse Club and Annette and Cubby. I lived with my mother and stepfather, and my stepfather, he was a waiter at Amato's, which is another neighborhood place, although I can't remember the streets exactly. And my mother worked at Gill's, J.K. Gill's, and they met in AA, a sort of recovering alcoholics, but after a while working at Amato's, which was a supper club, made it a little hard to stay on the wagon. And so once he started drinking again, he was kind of a mean drunk. And my mother and I would, if things got too bad, and pulling in the Murphy bed didn't help, then we would go to the St. Francis Hotel, which was about 2 or 3 blocks away, and stay overnight. And it's a residential hotel now, I think. In the living room, my mother and stepfather had a pull-down Murphy bed. And in the other room, I had a pull-out Murphy bed again. And this, in the big closet, my stepfather kind of created this. It was my playhouse. And it was, it had sort of an upper shelf where there was a little ladder and I could get up there. And I remember my stepfather would bring me lots of Mexican jumping beans, and that I had 13 parakeets. Yes. I don't remember the noise. I just remember their colors, the chartreuse and blue, and some were solid.
That seems so bizarre to me.
Well, it was bizarre. That's where my mother stuck her head in the oven and then disappeared for a while. So it was, there were many extreme things.
My arms were throbbing from being pinned down. My head was spinning. By then, I was no longer drunk. I was feeling the most nauseous and hungover sick I had ever felt in my entire life. And it happened so fast. The way my body was unable to process what was going on. So we get down to the station and I'm led out. And this is sort of vague memory. I remember having to take all of my jewelry off, which I was really angry about because I don't ever take my jewelry off. And I felt like they would for sure never give it back to me, and I was gonna have to talk to someone about this. So that was a big thing at that moment. My friend started throwing a fit and yelling about how he was dyslexic, which I thought was sort of funny at the time. I'm not sure why that had any relevance at all to what was happening. So he got led away to a solitary room, and he was in there for quite a while, which was scary for me because then I felt really alone. So they did my strip search, and I had to wear these awful things on my feet. I'm not even sure what they were. They might as well have given me plastic bags to wear on my feet. It's just something similar. Really non-human, I guess. And I was told to sit in this waiting area, so I waited for about an hour watching, I think it was a rerun of Oprah on the TV, with a couple of other girls who had seemed like they had been there quite a few times and knew what was going on and knew the people, and that was sort of amusing for me. I then went where my name was called then, and I was led to a place where all I was told was to look up, and my mugshot was taken. But when I was told, I sort of looked around to see who was telling me that. And then I heard a woman say, "We're gonna have problems with you since you can't follow directions." And I just kept looking around, like I just didn't know who was even talking to me or where I was supposed to look. So I got my mugshot taken and was given a bracelet with the picture on it. And it was the most hilarious picture I've ever seen. I didn't even look like myself at all. No recognizable features of my face. Just total terror and bewilderment and anger. I was really angry at that time about how I had been treated, and anger at myself for being so immature and irresponsible. And then I was led to, it was an open area, but the men and women were divided by a half wall. So I was with about six or so other women who had definitely been there before. And at that point, I was there for about another 5 hours, just waiting there. And I think I spent the next 5 hours thinking that I was going to throw up everywhere and how humiliating that would be for me to throw up. And that was pretty much my only thought, I think, while I was sitting there. That seemed like a really big deal, that I was going to throw up. It just feels so contained. Like, there is no way you're getting out of there. Your thoughts are there. Your body's there. Everything is right there. It's scary to feel like you have no control. That those voices that are calling your names are the only ones that can tell you what is going to happen to you. It seemed never ending. Finally, my name was called again. And these are all faceless figures who are calling my name. It just seems like my name was called. I don't remember the people. I don't see them when I think about it. So my name was called again. And I was taken to another room where I was given my bag of belongings and clothes and my jewelry, which came back to me. And I went to another room where someone gave me a paper that told me when my court date was to be. And then I was told to go and wait out in the entryway to the courthouse. So I made it through. And once I got out there, I started to put my things back on and tried to get myself together. And I walked outside. And I have never felt so free or so alive in my life just after having gone through that. And then I came down really hard, and I was sick for quite a while, trying to process what had happened and think about it, because I think I experienced so much in just that one night. I was sort of all over the board with my emotions and my thoughts. I walked all the way home from downtown, and that was my night in jail. It's something I will never forget. Yeah, that was an interesting night. I would totally tell anyone to do it if they had the chance to break into an abandoned building. An abandoned school building. For me, this was just like, finally, I'm being the explorer that I've wanted to be since I was 5 years old. And that's what I was doing. I was exploring. I have an inquisitive mind. When I told my mom about it, she didn't even really react. I think she said something like, "Well, did you see anything good in there?" Which was so perfect. Oh, so I had to do 8 hours of community service following that and walk around downtown with a smelly orange vest that hung down to my knees, I think, with my face just on the ground. I couldn't even look up. I was so ashamed. But, you know, I think it's good to feel those things sometimes. So no one is above it. We can all be there.
Well, it's right downtown on probably about 4th and Washington or Alder. at a bus stop. What it was, it's like 1959. We'd been to a Beavers baseball game, which happens at Multnomah Stadium, now known as PGE Park. And we were kind of poor kids, and our parents weren't around much, so we rode the bus. So my friend was from St. John's, and I walked with him all the way down to the bus stop so he could go home. And, of course, the ball game was an evening game, and it's about 10 p.m. And we're just standing there. We're kids. We don't suspect anything's wrong. The police car pulls up, and the police car stops, and they roll the window down, and they ask us who we are and what we're doing, and we told them we'd just been to a ball game, and I'm taking him home, then I'm going to walk back to where I live. And they say, well, get in the car. And so we kind of question, well, why? You know, what's up? And they go, well, there's a curfew. And they didn't explain. They just said, there's a curfew, and you're in violation of the curfew. And we'd never heard the word before. We didn't even know what it was. And they didn't explain. They just took us to the downtown precinct, which is like on Oak or Pine and about second or third, somewhere down there, and did the whole process of arresting us. You know, fingerprints, put us in a cell, and the cells were like horrible. The cell was actually like what you would keep like an animal in. It was just a cubic concrete box with a toilet and then just a metal bunk. And that was it. And it didn't have bars either. It was a solid door. Clunk, and there you were. I mean, there was nothing to do but sit on the bunk. There was nothing else in the room. And just wonder what's up and what's going to happen, and have thoughts. And my thoughts were about the other people who had to be in there in a more serious situation, that this is where people who went to jail went. And I had not really thought about what it was like, because up till then, all I had seen was like Westerns or gangster movies, and I didn't know what a real jail was like. And the whole building, from the moment you enter, is not what you would expect. It's actually worse than what you would expect. It's not worse in a horrible way, but in a sort of a dry, lifeless way. Everything is like rubber stamped. Nobody looks you in the eye. And they just treat you like, well, not like a person at all. They treat you like an object that's now going to be put away. Another thing that happens that helps to dehumanize you is that you are passed from hand to hand, from person to person. The two who pick you up take you in, and then they walk away. And now someone else has you. They lead you down a corridor, and now you're in the fingerprint room. That person leaves, the fingerprint person has you, and so on. And so each of them just does their little part. And that's part of why you realize you're in a big system. There's so many people, and all these stages you go through, and none of those people has the desire or willingness to talk to you as a person and say, oh, look, you're all upset. You know, let me explain. None of them do that. It was not obvious to us that we had done anything that was worthy of even having the police's attention. You know, we weren't like lurking or acting suspicious or just standing on where there was a sign for the bus at a bus stop. Kind of obvious what we were doing. That was the only time I got to have any sort of relationship with the police when I actually didn't do anything wrong. Well, in 1959, it was a much smaller city. And I do remember that downtown was pretty much completely empty at that time of people. It was deserted. There was virtually no car traffic and no foot traffic either. We were the only ones around. And I think the officers may have just been bored, actually. Nothing else to do. They were cruising around and they thought, okay, here's something to do. And so they did it. I knew that it would get eventually cleared up. I was a little scared of spending too long in there, though. I was thinking, after about an hour, I started getting fidgety and wondering how long it was going to take, because I knew that it would be hard to find our parents, because all we could do was guess which tavern they might have been in that night. You know, I'm sure, I don't remember that specifically, but I'm sure we gave our home phones and some tavern phone numbers to the desk sergeant or whoever to start calling around to find them. Then, of course, our parents, they weren't upset. They thought it was all kind of funny, really. And they seemed kind of glad that we'd had the experience. You know, they just kind of smiled at us like, well, now you've learned a little something more about life.
I am very new to the city and really overwhelmed by my newness. And I have an okay idea about where I am downtown, but not so much. I am on the corner of 3rd and Ash, and I decide to walk back along to the Burnside Bridge, back over to my neighborhood. And I have never done this before, and I'm scared and overwhelmed. I'm very overwhelmed. And I see this couple before me, and they strike me because they're so mismatched. The man is mammoth, just huge and lumbering and stomping along. His clothes are worn and sort of falling off of him. He has a long ponytail that is greasy and seems like it has been there forever. And his partner seems almost like a child. She's bird-like and pigeon-toed. And her clothes are ill-fitting and hanging off her too, and dirty. And they are holding hands in front of me, and I'm just very struck by the image of them, because it seemed really oddly beautiful to me to see them together. Just their awkwardness, I guess. So I decide to follow them, and I sort of lose sense of where I'm going at this point because I'm so drawn to them. As I'm following behind them, I'm just focusing on the way they walk. It's very uneven and sort of pounding and really agitated almost, and very quick. And they're silent, except for the man smoking his cigarette, which is really loud and raspy, and it seems like he has probably been smoking forever. And I'm walking behind them, and all of a sudden the man almost bellows, it seemed like. It is no accident that we have accidents of the soul. And I'm so in awe of this declaration that I decide I have to keep following them. And the woman looks up to him and then turns her head back down to the sidewalk, and they walk on for a while. And then he says again, "We are dismembered, misplaced, we are accidents of the soul, and they will never get us." And then the woman almost seems to rise to his level, and it's almost screaming in a really raspy, screechy voice, and she says, "No, they will never get us, no, sir, ever, they will never understand us." And they continue on. And this was so beautiful for me, and at this point I am entirely lost, having followed them for blocks and blocks past where I knew to turn, but feel as if I am a part of them. And this was the perfect misguided walk for me.
And this should not have worked this year. We have a party just north of Steel Bridge. There's a little marina there, but it's too shallow for any boats. So all you have are these just very tiny boats, if they have any boats at all. And there's a place where Canada geese hang out. And there's a little beach there, so we can make luminarias, you know, little paper bags, put a little sand in them, put a little candle so that we can make a nice little pathway so everybody who comes knows where the party is. And the party is just a couple steps up near what's called McCormick Pier. It's now used to be a rental community. Now it's an owned community. And there's a little fire pit there. We do a little fire and we have soup and hot cider. So we've done it a couple of years, and this year it fell during that disastrous period. Remember that disastrous period when we were all prisoners of our house? Everything was closed. So annoying, just completely annoying. So it was about a week into that, and we were so sick of being inside, and everything's being canceled. Everything's being canceled, and I'm really, really disappointed because I'm the person who's supposed to communicate things, and I'm saying, I guess we have to cancel it. My friends in the neighborhood association say, hell no, why should we cancel it? So we had it, 18 degrees, and lots of people came. It was pretty good. It wasn't as many as we would have hoped for, because a lot of people in the social service agencies, their people are so vulnerable that they refused to announce the party to them. They said, we couldn't tell them to go there. It was 18 degrees. We can't have them standing outside around a fire with two logs in it. That won't work. So we went, and it was really, really cool because, of course, the Christmas ships, now they are, there is no hero better than the Christmas ships. We should all be lined up along the waterfront when the Christmas ships come by. This is absolutely amazing stuff. I sensed it was amazing some time ago, but I never realized how amazing it was until I actually got invited to see the Columbia River Fleet. And up there, there are hundreds of people who sing Christmas carols with the people on the ships. And it's every third night of the week there's a party. So particularly if you go to the floating home communities, you know, there's hundreds of people sitting on the roofs of their houses thinking nothing of whatever the temperature was. And this year it was cold the whole period. So this year we were the folks that welcomed the ships to downtown Portland. And there was like nothing else going on. There's nothing on the waterfront. You have to go all the way to River Place to find people who were watching the ships. And it was so neat because they paraded between the steel bridge and the Broadway bridge, and then five or six of them came up right to the edge where we were on the riverbank, and they pirouetted. They turned clockwise, and then they turned counterclockwise. And do you have any idea how difficult that is? I mean, night navigation is a no-no for most boaters. I mean, you just don't do it unless you have to. And all that distraction of lights and red lights and green lights and city lights and cars on bridges. And these sailors are out there in 18-degree weather, in the sleet, in the snow. And they're doing pirouettes in front of our poor, cold neighbors that are standing outside to watch them. It's really marvelous. They're the unsung heroes. 54 years they've been doing that. And they do it all at their own expense. They take no corporate funding. They refuse to. So that's the type of thing to cheer on.
Okay, thanks to everyone who donated memory and or money and or time. Thanks to Iraq for their support. Thanks to the bands for donating their music. Thanks to my friends and family, and thank you for listening. You can find out more about this and other projects at www.hoodturkey.com. Thanks, and have a safe trip home.